So, good morning, Professor Rudnick. As we've mentioned ahead of time, the purposes of this interview is to discuss the period during which reticulocytometry braking was developed, roughly from 1975 to 1995. But to get us to that, there's a few questions that we'd like to bring up. And in particular, in your contribution to the Walter Kohn phase shift, you described how and why and how you chose to become a theoretical physicist. Given that your father was himself a physicist, was it even an option for you not to become a physicist in the first place?
That's a very good question. I think if I had discovered I was no good at it, I wouldn't have done it. But no, there was this strong, feeling. It was almost a religion in my family, physics. And I was the oldest son. In fact, my brother once commented that I was the one who went into the family business. And I actually remember that I envied people who went into physics because they were so drawn to the subject. They were, for me, there was a very strong feeling that, not that it was expected of me, I don't, but that it was a way of fulfilling some kind of a, I don't know. Destiny, or I don't know what. Imperative.
After your PhD, you had a number of postdocs, right? And at UWash, at Technion, at Case Western Reserve, I think, as well. But during those postdocs, you seem to have had a relatively high degree of autonomy, meaning in choosing your problems and in choosing your questions of interest. So, could you tell us a bit what guided your problem selection at that time?
I kind of fell into some of them. My first postdoc was to me a tremendous disappointment, and I thought, and I actually feared it would end my career in physics. I don't know if you look at my publications. My publication rate was pretty sparse in my 3 years at the University of Washington, and part of it was that I and the person for whom I was a postdoc had different ideas about what was important. I worked with him especially on a kind of a something that obsessed him that I felt was not worth all that much attention. And I was not that good at actually deciding what I should be doing myself. So I published one paper based on my dissertation. I wrote another paper and referees criticized it, and I didn't have the self-confidence to, rewrite and resubmit. And then I published a couple of papers with him. The second one, actually, they pretty much told me when I was at Technion, their people, I had met them much earlier in 1965 when my father was on sabbatical in Israel and worked at the Technion. I'd say they're kind of friends of the family. And so when I went there, they pretty much told me to do whatever I was interested in. And actually, on the way to Israel, it was 1972. My father was also on sabbatical. He was in sabbatical in France. And I think he was at Saclay. He was ever wherever Degen was. When I got there, I can't remember who it was. Somebody pointed me to it was somebody there pointed me towards this article that had just by Kenneth Wilson that had just come out, his first paper on the renormalization group. And I remember trying to read it and finding it completely impenetrable. And then I went to Israel, and they kind of told me I could do whatever I wanted. But one of them said, why don't you read that paper and tell us about it? Because this seems to be a hot new topic. And so that's what I did. I then seriously read the paper, and then I had some ideas of my own. And that started me working on the renormalization group. And I was fortunate enough to write a couple of papers that were noticed. Then when I was at the end of that, I was looking for jobs back in the United States, and I got two offers. And one of them was an offer of a faculty position at Tufts University, and the other one was a postdoc at Case Western. And I was told, I can't remember in writing or in a phone call, that they would do their best to find me a faculty position, that there wasn't an opening at the time, but they would try to find me one. So, and somebody told me, somebody I just talked to said, oh yes, you should go to Case Western, because who has heard of Tufts? And that was not a smart decision. But I went to Case Western, and what had happened there is the departments at the Case Institute of Technology and Western Reserve College, they were institutions across the street from each other in Cleveland. They merged. And as it turned out, that involved the merger of two full-size physics departments. And then what followed, it was described to me by the one of the 18 assistant professors at the time who actually survived the process, what was known as the purge years. They lost, or, you know, didn't give tenure to or fired 17 of the 18 assistant professors. And there was a lot of pressure of them not to grow. So I never got the promised offer. But there I had already started working on RG, and that's when I continued doing it. And then I just fell into the interest in spin glasses. That actually came about when I took a small leave and to UC San Diego and worked with Shang Ma. And together, I think largely, he really drove that collaboration. We came up with a model for, as I can't remember, spin glass dynamics. And that's how I got in the spin glass.
So that's the first time you heard about spin glasses at that point?
It's the first time I heard about spin glasses, you know, and then I read the papers of, you know, Edwards and Anderson and, you know, and Sherrington Kirkpatrick, of course.
So you I think you then went on a summer leave to IBM as well. Is that possible?
Well, I was paid for the academic year. And so I didn't get paid during the summer. And I was invited to go to IBM. And I think I did that for a few years. You know, I worked there in the summer.
Okay. And that's where you met Ehrlich Bitte.
Yes, that's where we met.
Okay. So can you tell us a bit about the genesis of that collaboration or that meeting and how you decided to work together?
Well, I'd already been working. I'd started working with Shang Ma, and to tell the truth, that's one of the cases where I don't know how it is that we got seriously involved in it together. It just started. It came. I suppose we had mutual interests. I don't think he'd done any work on spin glasses prior to that. He was kind of the manager of the research group. Mm. So he was kind of interested in a lot of things. But yeah, I think that our first work was what it was called, Scaling Equation of State. Yeah. And I think that's one of the works which I'm happy about, because, you know, I think we figured out, worked out some things.
And the first work is actually with Robert Pelkovitz, with a Harvard student. Yes, that came out.
Was that the one on the random anisotropy model?
The spin glass and ferromagnetic behavior induced by a random uniaxial anisotropy.
Yes, okay, I didn't realize that that was the first one, yeah.
So do you know where Sheng Ma got his interests in spin glasses? Where did that sort of emerge?
I don't, you know, again, I don't know whether it was he or I that first brought it up, to tell the truth. It's often hard to tell, you know, what starts a collaboration. You know, you generally starts with a cup of coffee.
Sure. So you told us a bit about the paper with Pitta and how that came about. So how did you had a particular intuition to the instability, or were you just applying RG or applying the tools you already had, or what do you know what led to this particular direction being chosen?
Oh, well, in the case of the random anisotropy model, I think that was me, of the three of us, is we were looking at random anisotropies. And of course, at the time, you know, one of the things that you naturally did when you were looking at statistical mechanical systems is you look at, you know, you go to the n equals infinity limit, because, you know, it was well established that in, you know, some cases like, you know, the ON model, the n equals infinity limit was the spherical model, you know, that famous paper by Stanley. And so there's sometimes the thought, maybe the hope, that in that limit, things would simplify. And then maybe you could even, if they did, then you could think of, well, then maybe I can do a 1/n expansion, you know, and kind of perturbatively build on that simplification. I can't remember how random anisotropy was in the literature, random anisotropy axes were in the literature. And I think it was me that I looked at the n equals infinity limit, and I realized that if you sum the diagrams that dominate in the n equals infinity limit, you end up with a model in which there is no negative gap. You know, you don't have the De-Almeida thallus instability. And I think that's what gave rise to that collaboration, that we worked together to try to understand that better. The hope was, at least for me, that now we can go to 1/n and somehow, that being controllable, we could maybe deal with it perturbatively. And I have to admit that there came a point where I felt like, no, this is not working out neatly the way I had hoped. And I dropped it. And then Yadin Goldschmidt took it up, of course.
So before we get to that, in some of your papers, especially the 1981, you mentioned the close, the special collaboration or special discussions with Cyrano de Dominicis. What was your relationship with the Paris group, or how did you interact with the spin glass community in Europe in those years?
I'm trying to remember. It was already 81 when I had talked to him. Which one now? The 81 paper? Which?
No, it's a 1980 paper. The means field mean field theory of spin glass, I think, is a title.
You'll have to remind me of that.
Is the paper in which you studied the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model using a kind of diagrammatic expansion, and you show that you I mean, you reproduce the Almeida Tauris stability, and then you discuss that this points to the fact that you cannot describe the spin-glass phase in terms of a single order parameter.
Oh, okay. So is that the one with Erling Pitta?
No, it's you on your own.
It's just you.
Oh, I am embarrassed. I don't even remember that paper.
Okay.
It's a nice paper.
Oh, well, thank you. I am trying to remember that paper. 1981. So I was in 1980, which means I was at Santa Cruz. Did I write that while I was at Yorktown Heights? Is there an affiliation there with IBM listed?
Give me one
this
second.
This is where I would have to go back and look at that paper. I'm very embarrassed that I don't remember what that was.
Your affiliation is Santa Cruz, actually, in this paper, and there's no other.
So that was, wow. Okay. If possible, could we defer conversation of that, and sure, I will look it up and refresh my memory.
You can also annotate it in the transcription in writing.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that. I'll call it up and I'll read it and I'll try to remember it. I mean, the one that I remember was with Erling, where we actually traced, we could actually trace down the source of the instability, to a single term in the partition, the partition function in terms of the matrix, that Q matrix. And we could verify that it all depended on the sign of a coefficient, and we knew what that sign had to be. And, the thing that I also was pleased by is, there was discussion at the time that maybe this negative gap was a mathematical nuisance, but that it may not have signaled some kind of a inherent pathology in the replica symmetric solution. And the other thing we showed is that a negative value for that gap was inextricable from a negative value for the replica average of the square of something. So, of a real quantity. So it was absolutely wrong. It was it was intolerable. And then tracing it back to the non-Gaussian statistics of the spins. I thought that I liked that because that was at least firm and I think unassailable.
So when did you become aware of the Parisi proposal, Parisi solution? And how did you react to it?
Along with most people, when it was published, and then talked about broadly. And I remember the form of the solution, the ultramatricity, and how he structured the matrix, this Q matrix, and I thought it was very clever, but something at this point I didn't know. And I think he did some very important work linking that to things that you could calculate without replicas. I never felt like I had enough of a intuitive grasp of it to do anything, to work with it. I just said, this is very nice, and maybe it's the solution. I there's no way I could see myself contributing.
And that's how you left the field. Roughly coincides with that reaction, or
well, I mean, I did work afterwards. I did the work with Anu Jagannathan and a graduate student of mine, Sakhar Eva. We wrote Anu and I mm-hmm. wrote a paper on, kind of looking more closely at the structure of the mean spherical model spin glass, and then we just noticed this funny little feature of the Bose-Einstein condensation that you could translate into Parisi-like structure of the Q, this Q matrix. But I thought maybe you could look at that further. And I wrote a paper, a subsequent paper many years later, but I don't think it really led anywhere useful.
So this came about 10 years later, right? And did this work?
Yeah.
So were you following the discussion in around the replica symmetry breaking throughout, even from a distance? And that's how you could see the connection?
No, actually, at that point I tried, but I just never felt like I know that Cyrano and I think it was Politi, I'm not quite sure who was his collaborator then. You know, they looked at the kind of first fluctuation correction to the mean field theory in the Parisi ansatz. And that was impressive and intimidating, that work. And again, I felt like I was not, you know, I didn't have any insight. And maybe I was a bit too lazy to try to reproduce their calculations, which were quite elaborate.
Certainly, absolutely.
Yeah.
Did that experience working in spin glass related topics influence the rest of your work in theoretical physics, or there's a before and an after? Are they completely disjoint?
They're not completely disjoint, but I don't know that I can trace any connect. I mean, you know, I think an experiment is useful even when it's not necessarily productive. And I think one of the things I can say I did is I discovered some of my limitations. I didn't have either the mathematical background or the intuitive insight to be able to work with something where I just didn't, you know, Parisi is is brilliant to the point of genius. And I knew I was not at that level. And
so as you left UCLA, you Santa Cruz and moved to UCLA, Santa Cruz recruited Peter Young to come in.
Yes, they did. It was a brilliant hire on their part.
Were you at all related to his recruitment or to that effort?
No. No. I had gone to UCLA and I made an offer to Peter Young and I congratulated them and he accepted. I congratulated him on it. I think I told Mike Nauenberg there, you know, who I still communicated that it was a incredibly fortunate, you know, because I was aware of his work on two-dimensional melting, you know, and the fact that he single-handedly was producing work of the same quality and impact as David Nelson and Bert Halpern working together. So I thought that, you know, I was extraordinarily impressed by him.
So as you got to UCLA, you quickly became department chair or department head, I forget, and then you served a second term later on.
Yes.
and then became dean, right? So you played a pretty significant administrative role there. Was there at any point a chance for you to influence the recruitment of spin glass or RSB related physicists on the team?
As chair and I suppose I certainly played a role in the recruitment of Sudip Chakravarti, you know, and he had done very important work on, you know, using high temperature expansions on the nature of spin glasses, you know, and the existence of a spin glass transition. So I was very much involved in that, but I think in that case, it was just that we were looking to hire in that area, and by very fortunate circumstance, both Sudip and Steve Kittleson, you know, who are then at Stony Brook, applied for the position. And it was a single position, and we had a very sympathetic administrator in Ray Orbach, of course, who had an experimental interest in spin glasses. And he pretty much saw to it that, well, not only were we allowed to make two offers, he allowed us to make three offers. The third one, Banarovas, we didn't succeed at, but of course, Shudeep and Steve came. But it wasn't, I don't think that I felt, it was programmatically driven. It was, you know, that, I mean, we got Shudeep and Steve because C.N. Yang had an Institute for Theoretical Physics at Stony Brook. And for reasons that I cannot fathom, Shudeep and Steve were not offered membership in that institute. And I think they were both felt, well, I think with good reason, they felt that that was, you know, that that was an unjustified snub of them. They were at least as good as the theorists that were in that institute. And in fact, they were both offered membership at the point they had our offers, UCLA offers. I think at that point, the damage had been done.
Yes, yes. So you mentioned Bert and David Nelson. Throughout your early work on, or your work on spinning glasses, you were in relatively close contact with them as well, right? You had just collaborated with David Nelson, and Robert Pelkowitz was a student of Bert Halperin.
Yes.
So were they encouraging these efforts in spinning glasses, either for you or for Robert, or were they largely indifferent? What was your impression?
I actually got to know Dave Nelson when he was still, I don't know if he was still a grad student or he was had just passed his, you know, just gotten his degree. When he was at Cornell, and I was actually trying to reach Michael Fisher because I had been in kind of correspondence with Michael. And I can't remember why I wanted to talk to him, but I called him up and Dave Nelson answered the phone call. Apparently the secretary, Michael's secretary, put Dave Nelson on. We just started to talk, so I'd never heard of him. And we started to talk and, you know, our mutual interest in RG just led to further discussions and a collaboration. I remember a couple of things about him. First was he has all this energy, and for reasons, you know, just prejudice. I assumed that he was not very tall, because I associated that kind of energy with shorter people. And of course I met him and he was quite tall. and he was not at all thin, and I was always associated that with thin people. It was you know, the stupid prejudice on my part. The other thing I remember about Dave Nelson is after spending time with him, my notion of who was good and who was not good was completely out of whack. Because I would then be asked to write letters of recommendation for people. And I would think of somebody, yeah, he's good, but he's not Dave Nelson. And so I would write this kind of measured letter and for some incredibly good people because they were not David Nelson. Yeah, so. You know, my calibration was subsequently adjusted.
But did Bert encourage a student to work on spinning glasses with you, or this was completely an accident?
I don't know. You would have to talk to Robert. I don't know what conversations he may have had with Bert.
I'm asking because your paper actually with him thanks Bert and David. That's why I was curious if it was you.
Okay, well. Trying to remember. I mean, I would have thanked David. I must have. Was that with my single author paper or
No. That's the Pelkowitz Pitta and.
So then that probably would have been Bob talking to Bert.
Okay. I see. So could you help us contextualize the U.S. response to replica symmetry breaking? I know it's a big ask, right? Because there's not the uniform response, but what was your impression of the reception of those ideas in American physics?
I think they were incredibly influential. And I think anybody who was working on spin glasses would have known about them and taken them into account. I mean, in the end, I think it was absolutely clear that it had to be broken. that the replica symmetric model had an inherent pathology. I don't think there was anybody. I cannot imagine that there was anybody who would have insisted on replica symmetry. Unbroken replica symmetry. I mean, certainly nobody that I knew of. No, that was, I think the first people who introduced it were Bray and Moore, as I recall. Mm-hmm. The one-step symmetry breaking. And then I think there were other, there were other versions, and then Parisi, the Parisi ansatz really seemed to be one that people settled on. But then of course there was all, maybe not uniformly, because with the Fisher and Hughes approach, right, the droplet approach, which did not, because part of this whole kind of notion of what was going on with the replica model is that there was this very elaborate multi-dimensional free energy landscape, right? And that if you're looking for ground states, it was something, and I know that Scott Kirkpatrick did a lot of work of this. His simulating annealing was invented to look for that. But then they actually proposed an alternate model in which there was a single ground state. So I say that it was not entirely universal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was an alternate claim. And I know that, of course, that Peter Young did simulations to try to see if he could find evidence for one or the other. And unfortunately, I can't tell you, what conclusion he came to, but can you tell me what he ultimately decided?
We can discuss this after.
Okay, yeah.
So, in the proceedings that you wrote for Ray Horbach, actually, you wrote a perspective on the replica trick, or yeah, some sort like it.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to teach a class either at Santa Cruz or at UCLA or elsewhere where you were teaching the replica trick and replica symmetry breaking or spin glasses? Or
I did. I taught a class. It was it was an advanced graduate course, on many body physics. Yes, I did teach a class, and I did introduce that.
At UCLA?
UCLA, yes, at UCLA.
Do any timeline? Can you give us details of what it would have included and when this could have taken place?
Yeah, it would have been in my early years there. It would have been in the mid to late 80s or early 90s. And it was a class actually in which I used the book by Parisi, his book, and I used it, and I wrote about, and I kind of talked about some of the things, and I actually felt like there were like many overwhelmingly brilliant people. When he writes, he assumes that you can make connections as fast as he did. And so I remember spending several lectures going over three pages of his book.
And so then you did eventually work through some of the math of the replica trick yourself.
Yes, I did. Okay. Yeah, I did. I just never felt like I had sufficient insight to do anything.
Yeah. Research-wise.
Yeah, to beyond reproduce what he had.
So is there anything else about this epoch or these times that we may have skipped over that you think we should be discussing?
Oh, that hurt. I can't. I mean, I do remember that, I remember there was a lecture by Mark Katz. I listened to, I think it was something called When is an Average Not an Average? And I think it really was, this was a time in which I kind of felt like the kind of model building, that really based on Landau's approach, especially as elaborated by Degen, it was felt like, if you came up with a good enough model, you would have a path to understanding a system, a straightforward path. And I think it's kind of when we were brought up short that some of these tricks, especially these ways of averaging random systems, with the use of replicas, that it was found that you could actually come up to a case where you could have a model that seemed mathematically perfectly justified that just did not yield to analysis, at least the kind that's of which most theoreticians are capable. So I think that was an important lesson. Again, just learning our limitations. I mean, aside from that, I mean, I can't think of anything that was a major issue or controversy or scandal. I mean, maybe if you could remind me of some.
There need not be any. It is just a...
Yeah.
So, Francesco, is there anything else you would like to ask?
Maybe, so one thing was that in the Fisher use droplet approach, I think was based on the idea of real space renormalization group and this kind of infinite randomness fixed points. Mm-hmm. While so you worked on a different RG, I mean where you do epsilon expansion from around in field. So was there any discussion during the 80s, like people try in the US to make contact between the two approaches and try to understand a little bit better each other. I mean, they are the two sides of the real space strong disorder and the field theory epsilon expansion.
Okay, now I have to admit, I never tried any calculations, using that. So I was never part of any discussions. So I can't comment on that. I mean,
so you never discussed directly with Daniel Fisher or David Hughes about this?
No. Okay. I never talked to them about it.
Okay.
So okay. The final question is, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive in some future?
I think I do. There's someone in a file cabinet. There's a couple of folders with, and I never thought to do that. I don't think I was considered historically important enough. The American Physical Society, if they decide that somebody is significant enough, then they will send an archivist to the person's office at some point and go through all the papers and decide which ones should be kept and which ones can be.
But so can UCLA, actually.
No, I haven't heard from UCLA. I mean, if there were an archive that I could contact, of one, I'd be happy.
I mean, I encourage you to contact UCLA manuscripts and archives. For instance, and initiate a conversation. Sheng Ma's archive, for instance, are at UCSD. He deposited, or his papers were moved there largely in the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
So absolutely, if you have, and you having served as an administrator as well, there are some university-related archives that they'd be happy to have, and it might just get lumped as a larger ensemble.
Okay, I'll reach out. I'll see, we'll probably have to wait until the end of the pandemic, because I suppose we'd have to get together in my office, but yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, thank you very much for your time. So we'll stop the recording.
Okay, this has been fun.